DEF CON. Hello, thanks so much for joining us on this very exciting panel discussion. We're going to be talking about exactly how Web3 is being used in Africa today and what are the types of innovations people are building. Early this week, we covered two really interesting threads of the impact of crypto. On one side, it is plugging African countries and economies into the global economy. That has been a hyper-globalizing impact and effect that traditional systems have kind of failed us. And we'll hear from founders who are basically at the leading edge of that movement in plugging payments, banking, infrastructure, but also other services that we need to live our lives into the broader global economy. And on the other side, there's a lot of amazing opportunities to go even more local than where we are going today. And we're going to hear about the hyper-localization impact that perhaps were not possible to do in this way before blockchain technologies became a thing. So I'm very excited to have an amazing group of people to cover these threads with us. We're going to do a very brief round of introductions, and we're going to jump straight into the deep end. And Jambi, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes. My name is Jambi Njoroge. I work for Grassroots Economics Foundation. Been working for the organization for the last 6 years now. I am an advocate for community inclusion currencies, for poverty eradication, and sustainable development. Super happy to be here.
And where are you from?
I'm from Nairobi, but I live in Kilifi, and that is also where I work.
Nice. If you guys have never been to East Africa, Kilifi is an incredible place to visit.
Ding, one, two. Awesome. Hey, everyone. My name is David Nandwa. I'm CEO and CTO of a business called Honeycoin and Peer. We are a B2B2C financial super app and treasury and payments platform. I'm based out of Nairobi, Kenya, and like super excited to be here. And thank you for all being in the room.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. My name is Yele Bademosi. I'm the co-creator of Onboard. We're building a borderless digital money app for people in the global majority markets with a universal on and off ramp gateway that allows anyone come on chain with as little as 50 cents whilst paying zero fees. I live in Lagos and London, but I call myself an African on chain. If you're wondering why I'm wearing a pirate costume today, I'm currently Pirate Uhuru, which means freedom in Swahili, and essentially I'm spreading the freedom of money. So thanks for having me.
Thank you. So David, I want to start off with you, and we'd just love to understand, what is the problem that you guys are really focused on when it comes to payments? And what is the gap that a project like yours is filling? And what's the scale of opportunity that exists there?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I think it really like sets the context for, you know, this conversation in general. Like, I would say for us, the main problem we're solving is when you look at a continent, any continent, you take any particular continent, Africa has over like 45 plus countries. We're pretty much addressing the fragmentation problem and the fact that the largest players on a financial stack, like banks, are not incentivized to solve that fragmentation problem. If anything, they benefit from it. Right? They benefit from the fact that someone in Kenya cannot do business with someone in Nigeria unless they're doing it through them, and they're going to make sure that like, they'll milk as much value from them when that money is moving, almost as if you're traveling physically, you know, to that particular market. And by solving and addressing that fragmentation problem, we strongly believe that as we build that plumbing, which is like this pipeline, it's almost like a hyper tunnel between different markets, between different corridors, we then now actually incentivize people to connect, do business with each other, actually have conversations on collaboration and partnership. So I see our work as important as, you know, in the US during the Industrial Revolution, when they were putting in the railroads to connect different cities across states and so on and so forth. And I think if we succeed, if we win, and why this problem is so crucial to solve is, as I mentioned in the beginning, there's very few players who are incentivized to solve it because their incentives lie in the issue. We see the incentives as being much larger than the issue, because when you actually create the initial plumbing, what you do is you open up a world of different use cases and different ways that people will now start to like actually think of, you know, how do I benefit and profit from this outside of just like, I'll profit off you having a very painful problem.
I like the analogy of plumbing and railroads. Those are like the base layer infrastructure that everything relies on.
100%.
Can you like give us even more concrete examples of why is that broken right now? Like with the lack of those infrastructures, how is value moving around? And what are the pain points in like in real terms?
Yeah. No, that's a good question as well. A good follow-up. I mean, like, I think to give you guys some context, right now, most banks don't even own the software that they're running their banking infrastructure on. And I'll frequently use the bank use case, because even if you were trying to build a Web2 fintech and your partner was like a core bank in X market and they had access to all of these different regions, you're basically just connecting to a pipe that's already leaking and trying to see how you can layer on an additional solution. Like, so that context, like the context of why we're in treasury, why we're in payments, why we're building a super app, is we have to, we're basically coming in to, in a way, like not build around, but Web3 and blockchain technology gives us the ability to give the banks, to give the licensed payment service providers, to give the licensed financial institutions this infrastructure, which is highly scalable. We can allow money to move at the speed of the internet, which is extremely crucial. But then also, we can, it's almost like in parallel, we're not competing with you, but down the road, the end goal is for you to stop being our competitor. It's for you to be our customer, right? And most of the people that we work with are, I mentioned the banks, the licensed FIs, the licensed payment service providers. They're those people because like we believe that initial beachhead will create opportunities for us to like permeate this technology, permeate the stablecoin payment use cases, the blockchain payment use cases around on and off ramping to like the broader majority of people in on the continent. And it starts though with the folks who have already, you know, deeply embedded themselves with what's broken within the financial system, especially on the continent. It's fragmentation one, it's, you know, white labeling software another, it's, you know, just bad, you know, code and like legacy Web2 technology on the third tier. And and all of those things is kind of like how I think we now get to scale, but we have to first start there. And that's kind of like, I would say, the impact to which we're working with these, you know, different licensed FIs, banks, and PSPs.
And Yeli, you've been in this space for a long period of time, trying to solve fintech before crypto, and then with crypto, trying to solve payments. And like, I'd love to hear, what are the patterns that you've seen on the continent so far?
So I think, Yosef talked about this idea of context. And so I want to help everyone level set. Imagine if the US dollar lost 90% of the value, or whatever currency or fiat that you had. So you had, I don't know, $1,000 in whatever currency, and then today the value after 2 years is now $100 due to no fault of your own. Or for most people, they don't even have money yet, right? So they can't even come into the financial system because they don't have any money, right? So if you look at the world today, over 2.5 billion people are living on less than 50 cents a day. 2.5 billion people. And these are people that live in global majority markets. So we're looking at like Africa, LATAM, Southeast Asia, India. And unfortunately, the world is still broken. And you know, when I first got into crypto, I got into crypto because I was fortunate enough to have been part of an early exit in 2015 or 2016, and began to support entrepreneurs in the Web2 space. And what I realized was two things. It wasn't because of talent that some of these ideas weren't working. It was primarily two things. Number one was the foundational infrastructure that we were trying to build this financial solutions on were broken. It was a combination of institutional problems. It was a combination of sort of weak currencies, and then also policies as well, right? And when I first looked at the blockchain, I thought like, wow, okay, this is something that we can use to really rebuild financial infrastructure from the ground up and equalize access to opportunities regardless of where you're from. And so it's been really interesting seeing the rise of stable coins, and you know, everyone now is talking about stable coins, and it's like, okay, finally everyone gets it, right? Because you know, people complicate stable coins, but I think of stable coins as essentially putting the US dollar on the internet. And the same way how when you don't understand or have, you're trying to learn something, you can Google it and then you have access to that information immediately. When you do the same thing to finance, a lot of positive things will happen. And so, but yeah, that's sort of, you know, just a little bit of context and, you know, why I've been building and really excited to contribute to this space.
Mm. So a few weeks ago, actually, Chainalysis came out with a report of crypto use across the world. And one of the stats they put out there that is that for traditional payments to move money from one country to another, and we keep talking about that because Africa is a continent of 54 countries. And so whenever you're crossing value across any of those borders, and you run into a lot of SWIFT and global financial system challenges. So if you're crossing value across borders, I mean, information cross borders very easily, right? But when value crosses borders, you're taking a 15% haircut, 1.5. That's what Chainalysis put out there. Other reports that I've seen show, you know, in real life, it's around 8 to 9%, depending on how much value you're going. And like David, just even knowing what HeineCoin is doing, I'd love to understand a bit of the types of customers that are coming and using your infrastructure to plug into the global economy. Because these are not like crypto fanatics. These are not people who are coming to DEF CONs or crypto conferences. These are people running the traditional economy, right? So can you just share a bit about like why are they coming to you? What are they getting from you that they're not able to get elsewhere?
Yeah, I think, and you know, it's literally what fuels me to keep going. I think a larger percentage of our customers are non-crypto, non-Web3 companies than they are like just traditional Web3 companies. And at the moment, we're serving some of the larger enterprises. Like I'm talking, you know, traditional FMCG or like retail, the likes of Bidco, Unilever. On the banking side of things, we're working very closely with, you know, the United Bank of Africa's, the Equity Banks, the Brex's, Columns of this world, if you're in the US as well. And the reason I use the two partners that I mentioned, but then more so like these core customer use cases, there's businesses in logistics who are literally moving physical goods from Kenya to Tanzania, from Tanzania to South Africa and back. And these folks chose us because, and I like to always use this analogy, they chose us because financial infrastructure and financial platforms were left in the 90s in Africa, and we're trying to, you know, help them catch up. Right, and to give you context of what catching up actually looks like, before a provider like us, and there's a number of different providers, and you guys are welcome to do your research, I would have to go to my bank, fill in a physical remittance form, that's what we call it, just to pay for like an invoice in a country that is probably a couple of 100 kilometers between each other, right? That should not exist in 2024, but it does. And that's why a customer like them would choose us. The second reason they would choose us is we offer kind of like a more refreshing experience to what they're used to, in that the person you're serving, the person that is serving you, if they were an FX broker, if they were a bank, if they were Web2 fintech as well, who I have nothing against, to be honest. The person that's serving you would kind of like be offering you a solution, and it's as if they're doing you a favor, right? Like, you ask, you know, the exchange rate on Google is this. Why are you selling to me dollars at this price? I'll tell you, this is the price of the day, right? There's nothing you can do. And I think one of the non-negotiable rights is optionality as a human in general. Like, you should get to choose. You shouldn't be told, this is what, you know, exists. This is how life is. And so you should just go ahead and take it. And we're giving optionality, not just from like a platform perspective, like you can use us, and but we're giving optionality on a more deeper level in terms of like, look, we are not trying to sell you the same thing that has been sold in this market with the tier one banks, with the largest FIs, largest PSPs. I think back to like one of the more, you know, even funnier scenarios that it just happened to us this week. Like, we onboarded a payment service provider customer on Monday. On Tuesday, they were on a call with my head of products, and they were literally pitching, you know, our platform to their customers, right? That's the kind of, like, I would say, catalyst that excites me the most, because it's like this person is so excited about what's happening with folks like us, with the onboards, with the grassroots economics, that they're literally like, I will put you in front of my customers and tell them, look, it's better now, or it works, you know, it's efficient, it's faster. And those are all very colorful adjectives, but I think the tangibility of them is in those kind of like very traditional customers who would never touch crypto, but if you bring it to them in a way that actually addresses the solution, then you're solving a major problem.
It's interesting, what I've heard you say is that you're not saying, hey, like, let's destroy banks, let's recreate that. You're actually saying, let us bring a new value proposition that they're not able to do, integrate with them because they have different types of distributions, but create superpowers for money and build on top of them and like build the plumbing of like the global financial system. And I guess one quick thing I wanted to kind of plug in there is that when many of us keep talking about financial service applications, a lot of folks ask, what is beyond finance? What are innovations that we should do beyond finance? And what comes to mind for me when, you know, we talk that is, of course, we need to look at beyond finance. But if today, for example, for people in California, paying something on the same website, the same project based in Texas, if that took 4 weeks, and if you're paying 15% extra, and that was the case for all 50 plus states in the US, of actually moving value between all those states was so hard. And basically, if you're flying halfway on the plane, you had to change your monetary system, right? Like, I think we'll probably all drop everything and work on solving that problem, right? That's the problem that we're trying to solve from financial application perspective across Africa. And the reason why we keep focusing on it a lot is because it is like, where is like the train tracks, as you put it, that connects the foundations of a lot of our economies. And once we have a better infrastructure there, we can build a whole lot of things on top of that. But we keep coming back to the base layer, which is transfer of value, is because there's fundamental problems there. And over to you, Yele, on that. Like, the onboard vision is building a fully on-chain life. And I'll just love to understand a bit of how did you get to that place, and what does the world look like once we fully realize that vision?
Yeah, I really loved the example you gave of like the US and Texas and all that. I think it really does help understand, you know, what's happening on the ground in Africa. Like I said earlier, talent is evenly distributed, but opportunity is not. And I think that when we talk about this idea of a global on-chain economy, what is powerful about that idea is that it doesn't make your geography determine the quality of your life, right? We want to make your location irrelevant in terms of the opportunities that you have access to, in terms of the quality of financial services they have access to, and really building an economy that is open, that is transparent, and is meritocratic. We actually live in a world of abundance. right? It's just that, you know, that abundance is not freely spread. And that's why you have so many people in poverty. And we know the reason why we all feel upset and unhappy about the state of the world today is because we know that the current system just doesn't work. A lot of people don't have sort of their fair share or don't feel like they have agency about how to change and improve their lives. And this is kind of like what is creating a lot of the divisions and uncertainty and unhappiness, regardless of where people are from. And so, to me, the idea of an entrepreneurial economy, I know, you know, someone like Elon Musk says he wants to take humanity to Mars, and that's like an ambitious vision, and it's like, okay, we're gonna have rocket ships that will take everybody to Mars, and I think like that's amazing. But what if you just build an actual on-chain economy that is better than what we have today, right? And, you know, for instance, I'll give you an example. I haven't said this publicly, but I feel a bit comfortable saying this now. Like, my personal accounts were blocked over the last couple of months, right? And if there wasn't any crypto, I would have been really been in a very bad place, right? So the fact that I had stable coins and I had my keys gave me that agency and gave me that freedom of money that it doesn't matter where I'm from. And even if I, you know, I've been in Thailand for the last couple of weeks, I've been spending my stable coins with a card to pay for Grab and jumping on motorcycle taxis that I've never entered before. When I go to the US, it's the same thing on Uber. When I went to Brussels, it was the same thing. So when an individual has control over their money and is on chain, you know, it doesn't matter sort of where they are. They can move, spend freely, build their on-chain reputation. You know, a lot of people in emerging markets don't have a credit score, right? Imagine if in the US or in Europe, for you to buy a phone, you had to pay for it upfront at once. If you wanted to get a house, you had to pay for it upfront at once. If you wanted to go to university, before it upfront at once. So actually, in a lot of global majority markets, it's not that people are poor. It's the fact that they cannot actually leverage their reputation to get access to capital to build future for themselves. Right. And so, to me, the on-chain economy is giving everybody access to the same global world-class financial services, giving everybody control and freedom of their money, giving everybody control of their own on-chain reputation. Think about it as a credit score that then truly unlocks a whole host of opportunities, and they are fully empowered to create a better future, not just for themselves, but for the world around them. Thank you.
Yeah. And I guess the importance of that, just to even bring it down to specifics, in Nigeria, GitHub came up with a report earlier, like later last year, there's about 900,000 plus open source contributors on GitHub alone, right? So the GitHub page is their resume, it's not their LinkedIn, because no one will hire, like, just to be very blunt, people don't like to hire Nigerians all around the world unless they know them personally, right? But stuff like that is actually making it more meritocratic. And those guys are receiving income and salary in what way? Like, it is really hard to send money from elsewhere to Nigeria. Like, PayPal doesn't like to work in Nigeria. Stripe doesn't work in Nigeria, right? So the plumbing is broken, right? And so this is not just like a nice to have. It's a plan A for a whole lot of folks, right? So, yeah, I mean, and the other bit of what I think what you guys are building, which is very interesting, there are quite a few like other builders doing this, is you're moving fiat to stablecoin, and then in a self-custody or custodied wallet, and then you have a digital debit card. They can actually use that to spend internationally because your local banks have a limit of how much money you can spend. How much is it in Nigeria right now?
It's probably... There was a time when it was really bad and it was like $20 a month.
$20 a month.
So even if you had like thousands of dollars, you could only spend $20 a month. And you couldn't even go to the bank and be like, oh, I have, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 and I want to withdraw it.
Right.
It's like you can't withdraw that money, right? So or your dollar card won't even work on some websites, you know, just because the underlying plumbing wasn't working. And so that's why people and businesses have turned to stablecoins, because it disintermediates. It's like you as a person, you have the dollars, but the financial infrastructure is so broken that is preventing you from connecting with the global economy. And with stablecoins and blockchains, it's like, okay, Mr. Bank, get the F out. We don't need you. We're just going to connect directly to the global economy and transact freely. And that's kind of, yeah, that's the future. It's never the future. It's like the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed, you know?
So if you guys and a whole lot of other builders are radically successful, what we're basically doing is we are building the plumbing for our economies to easily integrate with the rest of the world. Our location is not a liability, but it's part of who we are. It's our culture, but that is not stopping us from fully participating, contributing, benefiting from the global world. Let us change the gear a little bit and come local. We've got Njambi here, who's building one of the most exciting initiatives in Kenya. Can you tell us a little bit about how you see the world and what you guys are building with Grassroots Economics?
Yes. Thank you so much. We have been working on a nice economic protocol called Commitment Pooling. So it's inspired by indigenous wisdom. So when I talk about indigenous wisdom, I mean traditions around mutual aid and mostly rotation of labor associations. So what we have noticed is that it's not a new concept. It's been there for ages and across nations, you know. So like in my community, we call it Mwethia. You know, we work with Kenya Red Cross at the refugee centers, and the Somalis call it GOB, you know, the guys from Burundi call it SLA, and every other community in Kenya like have a name for it. So it's not new. So what you're doing as an organization is really adding, you know, formalizing commitments, because rotation of labor really meant making promises to help one another. And these promises are really commitments. And I'm going to give you a good example. Like in a village X, there's family A, family B, family C. So family A will make, all the families will make commitments to help one another. And then they're going to pull their commitments together to bring about exchanging and accountability with agreed upon rules. So if family A needs a house built, that means family B and C will come and help family A, so they will fulfill their commitments, you know. Then family A has already accepted the commitments, so family B will do the same. They will accept commitments from family B and C, and they will get their farm tilled. So that means they have A and C has fulfilled their commitments to B. Eventually, they will balance out and clear the debt and start over again. So this whole protocol is not just with the humans, like it's across disciplines. And, you know, I would give one example of the plants just to show you how Grassroots Economics is coming in. Like the maize, the beans, and the squash, you know, for the longest time our ancestors have been growing them together because of the nutrients that they share. We'll see how the maize will bring the phosphorus, you know, the beans will get the nitrogen from the air, convert it, and the squash, the potassium. So the sharing is made possible, like how much of the phosphorus does the squash need. So that is made possible by the mycorrhizal fungi. So now the pooling aspect is now the mycorrhizal fungi, what Grassroots Economics is doing. So these commitments, Grassroots is formalizing them, adding technology, you know, making them have a value, number one. Number two, they have a special signature, you can't copy them. Number three, there's a demurrage, the deduction to make sure that you know, there's circulation, and also to make sure that the holder of, you know, these commitments can convert them from the issuer of the debt, you know. So That's the whole idea, like grassroots economics, you know, formalizing this and helping make a pool where community members can put in their commitments and pull out what they need. You know, also bringing out the aspect of resilience, because if, for instance, I do not need what you have, and maybe you need mine, I can use your commitments to get something else from the pooling. Yes.
Amazing. And can you share a bit about the types of commitments people are saying, hey, I will do A, B, C, D? And also just give us a bit of an indication, what is the scale of operation that is happening in this way right now?
So I'm going to give you a good example of where I come from. I come from Kilifi, and from my community, I'm in three groups. So group one is a group of women. They already have, you know, formed a group. They have their own vision. You know, they have their own rules, a constitution. So the idea when you go to a community is for them to understand the different assets that are in the community, for them to understand they have a lot to share, like the, you know, the social assets, the financial assets, the governance assets, at what level is each one of them, and how can they help one another. So you, in these groups, you know, we will see that there's a person who will have hairdressing skills, there's a farmer, there's a person who can tell stories, you know, they can teach traditional songs. We, you know, at the end of the day, there's just so much. Like in Kiriba is one of the groups, there's cooking skills, there's, you know, people who can wash clothes, there are people who can till land, there are people who can build houses. There are people who have food to offer. Yes, so that's a good example.
And so, like, my understanding is that a community is made up of around 20 people.
Yes.
And how many of these communities do you have right now?
We have 120 groups in Kenya and also beyond, Uganda, Colombia. Yes.
Yeah. And just give us a bit of an indication, how have people using this over the last years, like, the transactions you've had, and we can talk a little bit about the off-chain and on-chain element as well.
Yeah. So in Kenya, they use the USSD wallet, which is also connected to the web interface. So each of these users of the vouchers have a wallet. And so when they're doing the trades, they normally just send the vouchers. So for instance, when they're doing the rotation of labor, the hosts will accept these people to come and work for him, build a house. At the end of the day, the host will pay them with the vouchers. The next time, they'll go to someone else, and the vouchers will be paid. So there are going to be several pools, and the pools are going to be interconnected together by having a market day that is unique for, that is common for all the groups. So that is where the pools meet, and more services are exchanged.
That's amazing. So some of us came and visited the operations in Kilifi, and we actually used the USSD app. It's basically for feature phones. So you're basically using the telco network to send commitment vouchers to each other, and each transaction would trigger an on-chain transaction from a wallet that is actually connected to the phone number of that person.
Yeah.
Right? And did I hear correctly? There's a million transactions have happened?
1.2 million transactions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. And how many people used it so far?
We have 65,000 holders and issuers of these vouchers. Commitments.
So,
yeah.
So this is like rethinking what is money ultimately, right? Money is kind of a representation of a commitment. Yeah. It's a banknote. You'd use money to go back and get some value from a bank. Right. You guys have basically used actually DeFi primitives to recreate like a localized money system built with commitments. And these pools of a community connect to many other community pools.
Yes.
So there's basically like we're sharing liquidity, but liquidity is not like a dollar stablecoin. It is basically actual commitments people are making.
Yeah.
What has been the impact that you've seen so far in how this is changing people's lives? You talked about houses being built. Like, what have people been able to do with this?
Yeah. So I'm going to give you a good example of what I actually do and how I get to know all the kinds of impacts on the ground. So we are also borrowing another traditional practice from the past, you know. the idea of a council meeting. So every time the rotation of labor would happen and a cycle would end, the elders would meet and discuss matters community. Like, what are the issues we have? Like, what do we need to work towards? Is it a planting season? Do we need a water pan? You know? So that would motivate and also, you know, decide like what kind of activities they'll be meeting to do. So what we do, we now are doing is identifying like a community representative also from the community. And this is the person who is also going to be attending some of the rotation of labor associations and recording the kind of activities made. Like a house was built, 15 members, took 1 hour or took 2 hours, you know? And then, so what you do, the pools also accept stable coins like Celo Dollar. And this is really to support with communication. So what you're doing is like buying some of the monitoring and evaluation from the from these stewards, from the community. So when we put them into the pool, we put them prior, it's production financing, and then we take the vouchers, which are the commitments, or which the offerings, the monitoring and evaluation services. Once the report is sent end of the month, we send the vouchers back to the owner, you know, the monitoring evaluation services, vouchers, and then they are able now to go into the pool and take some of the Celo Dollar and eventually off-ramp those to Fiat. So to understand the kind of impact created, we are able to see the transactions on the dashboard, which also relates to all the reports sent, like these transactions today equals to 10 houses, 5 farms, 5 roads fixed, and this is from the community members. So also speaking to sustainability of this project.
Yele?
So we kind of all got together before this panel, and when I heard and I understood what this was, it was incredibly mind-blowing. And I wanted to just add some thoughts as to why this is really special. When I got into crypto, you know, one of the first things I read was Andreas's book, and it was talking about the history of money, and we talk about the barter system. Now, one of the challenges with the barter system is this notion of double coincidence of wants. So even if I have, I don't know, shoes, and you have a shirt, if you don't want my shoes, we can't transact. So this solution, first of all, solves that problem, because you don't need to want something in real time. It's sort of like this commitment. The second thing that I thought was incredibly valuable about this as well is I talked about this idea of the lack of credit, right? And how do you build sort of on-chain reputation, and how do you unlock capital? I think what is incredibly interesting about like grassroots economics and the work that you do as well is that people who don't have money can actually get something offered to them on credit without them having money and putting anything at risk. So we all talk about DeFi and things like that, but for you to get a loan on chain today, you need to have capital. So when we talk about 2.5 billion people that are not yet on chain and need access to opportunities, how do you unlock sort of those opportunities? So this is super interesting in that regard. Now, if you take this idea 2 steps forward, and this is why I'm so excited about what you're doing, and I'll round up quickly, but number one is that because every commitment is on chain, each of the 65,000 people now actually have on-chain reputation that can be used as a credit score to then actually give them real capital into that community, right? And in the final piece, when I think about it, is a lot of majority of Africa, almost everybody is doing sort of like agriculture. Now, people, small-scale farmers are farming, you know, goods and things like that that gets transported to the cities. When the farmers sell, you know, let's say maize, they sell it for $1. When it gets to the stores in the cities, it's $10. So if you're trying to create wealth, you want to sort of bridge that gap between the sale at production and the cost at consumption, and how do you bring that back into the villages? So for me, like, what you guys are doing is incredible, and I can't wait to build and co-create together. I think it's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's just so many ways. Yeah. There's so many ways to use the commitments. Even for big businesses, like, you know, they create their own vouchers to act as loyalty points. And this is also a call for everyone. Like, it's an open, it's for everyone. Like, there's so many ways to use the vouchers. Like, even market, you know, like I mentioned, loyalty points. Yeah, to keep your business going and to keep your clients coming. Yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of what you're building is not just technology. You're leveraging existing social infrastructures and trust infrastructures. And can you give us a bit of more context of where does that come from? Like, what are other patterns like Chamas that you've seen where basically social trust is the foundation for how we relate and interact with each other, even economically?
So, first of all, before, trust was really built when commitments were made, commitments were accepted, and commitments were fulfilled. So nothing recreated, same. So they're just doing exactly what they were doing then, and really making sure that now, at least now, the commitments have value. You know, it can be able to know like how much of my commitments are worth yours. Yeah.
And do we need the blockchain for that? The blockchain for that. I mean, that's one question someone might ask. Why are we building with crypto on this, in your opinion?
For visibility, number one. It also builds trust because you're able to see like how many of these are here. And also, you know, the confidence that I know I can get this even without money. Even the people who don't have money at that moment, they are sure that they will get what they have, you know, because it's on blockchain. Yeah.
And actually,
I was just going to actually add to that. And I think if you even look at like how big savings groups, so they're called SACOs in Kenya, are right now, they're holding tens of millions of dollars to the point where the government had to regulate them. And I think those kind of communities is what just tells you, like, people have been enabling and like coming together to organize themselves to build their own kind of like local bank. And in most cases, crypto is not really required, but what crypto does is right now, if you go to a SACO and ask them, how much can I borrow on? What is my collateral? SACOs mostly work also on a reputational basis, so you have to have a guarantor. All of those things are incredibly manual, which makes SACOs a painful process, even while they have AUM that would rival most microfinance banks and tier 3, tier 2 banks in a country. Right, bringing it on chain is literally the secret to now helping them to onboard so many more people much faster. And you know, you're not trying to replace their processes and like their the way they do things.
And there are hundreds and thousands of these circles in Kenya alone.
Yeah.
In Kenya, so these are basically small, like cooperative society banks of made of 10 to 20, 30 people. Right, it's crazy. And I think, you know, coming back to why blockchain perspective, it would be really hard to have 100 different commitment pools connected and actually sharing like commitment pools with each other. And I think that would not happen on paper. And like doing this on chain, and also, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, it becomes very easy.
Yeah. Yeah, and doing this on chain and having also a commitment pool with a pair of fiat pool, like with stablecoin or something like that, for people to exit if they want to. I think the most interesting part of this conversation for me is that we can do both. It's not about like, hey, Africa is screwed, so then maybe let's dollarize the whole continent. Stablecoins for everyone. That's helping in integrating us with the world, but that's not the only solution. I think what you're doing is actually making a level of localization that would be really hard to do on paper or with Web 2, like making that scalable, but in still maintaining the small element of it, I think it's super powerful. I think we should jump into questions from you all. Mark. While we wait for the questions to come up, any last reflections from you guys?
Yes, I think the part that we've not spoken about is this idea of like open finance, and that as a builder, I can contribute to her ecosystem without even having to talk to her, because these commitments and these individuals are on chain. And that is actually the truest form of innovation. It's just amazing to kind of see this future where we have like open financial services that just connects people, businesses from across the world.
We have a number of questions here. I want to ask briefly, is peer-to-peer trading a big thing in Africa?
The answer is yes.
So I was one of the earliest, the first African hire for Binance in Africa, and sort of worked on a number of things, including P2P, and also built probably the largest synthetic African stablecoin that was doing about 700 million a week peer-to-peer. So the answer is yes.
Nice. What Western builders trying to provide crypto services in Africa do not understand?
Yeah, maybe I can take that. I think the thing I've seen the most, which I always help my friends, especially if they're coming from like, you know, some geography, or you know, like let's say the US, Europe, UK, Asia, New Zealand, Australia, wherever, the thing they don't understand is fragmentation problem is not on a financial level only, it's also on a cultural level. Within a country like even Kenya, there's the Muslim community that needs Sharia compliant banking. So like a lot of crypto investing is like completely, you know, removed from them. Like they wouldn't be able to invest in most tokens, wouldn't be able to invest in crypto unless it was Sharia compliant. There's other nuances to say that, like as Yele said, you know, more than, you know, 2.5 billion people living under 50 cents a day. I think the banking, the unbanked pitch never, you know, goes well with me, because these folks don't need to be unbanked. They've already been unbanked. They're using mobile money. Their bank account is just an accessory for them. Understanding that is very crucial, because then you actually know how to distill a solution to them. And in some cases, a solution to them could be serving who they're served by. So going to the supermarket, going to the grocery store, going to the oil company, going to the retail chain, and helping them make their processes more efficient, because those costs go down and trickle down back to the actual people within like a particular market. Those nuances are always ignored, and you know, never go well, because when you think, oh, 1.4 billion people in Africa, you know, majority population under 25, all of those stats are very exciting. You're like, I'm gonna go ahead and launch it, and everyone will be amazed, and like they'll use what I'm building and like, you know, giving to them. But I said this on a video, and I'll say it again. It's like Africa needs water, not vitamins. We're in the point where we need necessity tools. And most people need necessity tools, they don't need nice to haves. When you come with that perspective, you will quickly distill a SaaS tool that helps you with time management, or you know, some kind of like productivity tracker. That's really not what the folks are looking for at this time. But if we do the low level, the low level plumbing stuff, then you open up the flow for those kind of use cases. And that's kind of like what I think Western builders, you know, might not quite understand.
We have like a lot of questions, so I want to be very short with my answer. In terms of what you can do as a builder thinking about the African continent, the best thing you can do is get on a plane and go to one of the cities. You would learn way more than anything, I would say, on the...
Yeah. And I have two quick takes on that. One is empire building doesn't work. If you're basically saying, hey, we're just going to create the Alipay that's going to eat everything across all of Africa and be the only thing, good luck trying to execute on that. I would love to meet you and wish you all the success. but it's basically a lot of pieces tackling different problems. And the second bit, it's a bit of a spicy take, is that there's actually profit in Africa. I'm sorry, guys. I know this is a weird term and frame for a lot of us building in crypto, but we tend to build with a lot of sort of assumed visions for the future. But there's a positive feedback loop by adding value to real people is they're willing to pay for it. So a lot of tools that we see like this across Africa actually are profitable. They're building actual businesses that can last a long period of time. And that's not a bad thing, and that's a great thing. What EVM chains are most widely used in Africa? And if there's a dominant one, why do you think that chain gained more adoption? And if non-EVM chain, then chains that are getting, what are the non-EVM chains that are gaining adoption? Jambi, you guys are on Celo, right? Can you tell us a little bit of, if you understand, why you guys chose to work with Celo specifically?
It's been a journey for Grassroots Economics. Like, we started with paper vouchers, and of course we went to digital. We've tried out with different blockchains, and Celo obviously became better because at least, you know, we have a validator now that people can stake into. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you guys are running operating a Celo validator, right? So that's a very interesting model. You're contributing to its success, but also using the chain. Yeah. And what about you guys?
Yeah, I was going to say, Ethereum is definitely like a primary, but like one of the chains people don't actually think about is like Tron. Tron is very big in Africa, and it's big for a couple of reasons, but one of the core primary ones is the exchange that was doing the most on the continent a couple of years ago is still quite big now, is Binance. There was a time where like the two primary chains they had was like Ethereum and Tron. We tend to think that people are like, oh, there's this huge EVM ecosystem, I'll jump to the next thing. But we're actually very simplistic beings, all of us humans, like where the first thing that I used is something that I'm comfortable with for whatever reason, and it's just maybe because it was like the first thing that I experienced. So Tron is massive in Africa, and then non-EVM chains, like even outside of the Ethereum ecosystem. Stellar is a huge chain that we use at Honeycomb and Peer, but we've intentionally made ourselves EVM compatible because we're seeing all of these different exciting, like, you know, new developments, like World, for example, you know, creating their own blockchain which is EVM compatible. That's very intentional because, like, for them, they want to own their ecosystem, own their users, and that's kind of like the only way to do it. But I think for me, like, Ethereum, Tron, Stellar, Celo would be the top chains that are most widely used in Africa.
Are these questions going to be available afterwards? Because these are like really, really great questions, and I wish I could answer like all of them. But I think we've kind of talked about the EVM stuff, and we have just two minutes. And I think maybe the last question is a good way to end the panel, which is just like, what crypto-based products do we wish existed in Africa? I'm generally interested in anything that actually allows an on-chain economy to thrive. And the most popular digital economic infrastructure in the world that is at what I call population scale, that is used by a billion people, is the India stack. But the India stack is very similar to M-Pesa. M-Pesa was mobile money owned by a particular corporation. The India stack is also technology that is owned by the government, right? USDC or USDT or stable coins is digital money that is on the blockchain. And so the India stack and ideas across identity, digital locker, and like moving that and putting that on chain as well, I think is the next sort of big, like really big meta. And people across the global majority are building these building blocks, and they're gonna be composable. So that stream is actually, when people talk about real world Ethereum, that's kind of like what I think, you know, the India stack on chain.
Quickly, you guys, what are the crypto-based projects you wish existed?
For me, like, one of the ones that's like been, you know, going across my mind for a long time is, so RPC layers that make crypto feel less scary for people. Now, I say that to mean, imagine telling your grandma that, no, you should have sent it to this Ethereum address. Now the crypto is gone. You send it to a random one on chain, right?
Right.
She will basically wonder, what are you even talking about? I tried to send you money. Can't you just call them and they'll reverse it?
Yeah.
Now, I don't have Vitalik's number, but I don't think anyone in the Ethereum Foundation can help if you send crypto to the wrong address,
yeah.
Right? But that RPC layer is interesting to me. Oh,
nice.
Because we need to build more guardrails around it. Yeah.
Jambi?
Is there an alias for the addresses?
Well, no. Like, even without ENS, I think that RPC layer is helpful.
Yeah.
So, like, in reverse, you can authorize transactions.
Yeah. Well, thank you all so much for the session here and for listening to us. I hope you found it valuable, and if you want to take this relationship to the next level, you're very welcome to visit the continent and spend time in many of these communities.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Big thank you to all the panelists. That was awesome. And have a lovely afternoon.